wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming at kboo.fm. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning, scholarships and other tuition opportunities available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. This is Lori Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Patsy Kohlberg is our engineer today. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The Mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. As always, you can subscribe to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website. And you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And you can contact us through that page or at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Leading off the hour today, the Mole's Bill Resnick talks to Jessica Tovar, an organizer for the Local Clean Energy Alliance of California, who describes how California cities and counties are taking over the electric energy systems from the privately held investor-owned utilities, such as PGE, and as quickly as possible with a new democratic structure, go all renewable. Then Jan Hocken and Fran Michelle review the science fiction comedy film Sorry to Bother You, written and directed by Boots Riley, which they heartily recommend. At the end of the hour, I speak with Martin Duberman, historian, playwright, and activist, about his new book, Has the Gay Movement Failed? From all of our guests and old moles, we learn that this is a moment of both great challenges and opportunities for reimagining future possibilities. Now here's Bill Resnick with Jessica Tovar.
Hi, Jessica Tovar. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Jessica Tovar is an organizer for the Local Clean Energy Alliance of California. She grew up in East Los Angeles, worked for decades as an environmental justice organizer in a variety of urban, rural, indigenous communities throughout California and Arizona. More recently, she concentrated on climate justice and was an organizer for Communities for a Better Environment in Richmond, California, who are the folks who are so important and partly civilizing the Chevron Corporation. And now she's an organizer for quite a few years now for the Local Clean Energy Alliance of California. Jessica, things are changing with regard to energy really rapidly in California. And the people of Alameda County, Oakland, Berkeley, Richmond, Hayward, nearly all of the cities of the East Bay, its people will soon be getting their electricity not from PG&E, which was their former private utility, but from a county, a public agency. It's called East Bay Community Energy. And they're going to be contracting with sun and wind producers of many kinds, other clean energy too. And all those customers will pay less than they paid for electricity than before when they were PG&E customers. You and the Local Clean Energy Alliance of California worked hard to make that possible. That's, of course, not possible in Oregon because the legislatures and the city councils and most of the environmental movement has been dominated by the two private big utilities in Oregon. But tell us about California, local community energy. How did it come about in California? How did East Bay Community Energy come about?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, I believe it's Assembly Bill 117 came about in 2002. So that was some time ago. It took a lot of organizing to get this policy for community choice energy off the ground. But even more so, it was difficult to get a project, an actual community choice program, off the ground because it was very controversial. We were battling, you know, monopoly utility corporation, Pacific Gas and Electric, otherwise known as PG&E. And I believe the first community choice energy program got off the ground in 2010. So there was a good 8 years of struggle there. And of course, you know, once the first program launched, that too was attacked by the monopoly corporation. So here we are now in 2018 in Alameda County, and actually, you know, just getting our community choice program off the ground wasn't easy. Folks had been advocating since 2007 to try to get a community choice program in the East Bay area. And you know, the details are pretty much dealing with multi-million, billion-dollar corporations. And that's a hard thing to do. But now, you know, fast forward to this year, we actually have a program called East Bay Community Energy. And so we're very proud that we were able to establish that. And this is pretty much opening the doors to the clean energy future that we want to see. So that's pretty much where we're at now.
Yeah, it's an incredible achievement when you consider the amount of effort that those big utilities put in to destroy you. In the beginning, through initiative after initiative, one of them, like $27 million, was spent. You had $500,000 to fight them, and that's in the whole state of California, and you won. It was quite remarkable, and they're continuing to do it, continuing to try and get the legislation that will make it very, very difficult for you to operate. And you've won every one of those battles over the years. That's really, what an incredible record. You've been part of it. So, Jessica, tell us a little bit more about the details of East Bay Community Energy and the others.
With East Bay Community Energy, we're very proud that the program actually launched on June 1st of this year. The program started providing electricity to commercial and municipal customers in the Alameda County area. And fall of this year, it's going to roll out for residential customers. So we're very excited about that. So one thing to just make clear, though, is that these programs, when they start, they do buy energy off the market. And so what we've really been emphasizing on is actually when you pay your bill, the electrical portion of your bill goes to this local East Bay Community Energy Program. So what we're trying to do is from the revenues of that money is actually start investing in local clean energy build out. So that would be like local solar, local wind, and energy efficiency projects throughout Alameda County so that we can start producing clean energy locally. And when it's in your community and you can see it and it employs your local community, it's real clean energy. And that's what we're working towards. That's pretty much the road to getting to a true 100% clean energy future.
Right. And do you have bonding authority? How do you, how would East Bay Community Energy build out on the local level and all local? What would be the sources of the capital? Could individual homeowners, for example, if they put, you know, they use their resources, the equity in their home to put a solar panel system on top of their house, or maybe even a small wind thing if they're sort of rural, can they sell then? Are they going to be reimbursed for the energy that they put into the system from East Bay?
So one of the things that we've really been advocating for is that before this project gets to even fund new projects, Your source of local clean energy is people who may already have rooftop solar, for example.
Right.
But offering incentives for them so that they can produce more, or folks that are thinking about solar can afford to do so, and they get incentives, be it, for example, they can make money, right, off of the excess that they sell back to the local program. And what's really good about this is that if you're a solar producer and the rest of your neighborhood is renters or owners that can't afford, to put rooftop solar, they're benefiting from the excess solar that you're producing. So it's being used by your neighbors, pretty much. So, you know, I like to think of the local concept of food. If you apply that to energy, it makes sense, right? You're producing energy locally, you're employing local people, for example, and then you're consuming it locally. And so that makes it more affordable, because it's like not needing to be, you know, transmitted far away, like in, you know, the model of desert solars, right? You can equate that to like monoculture type of farming. It's not sustainable when you do it far away and you employ other people and then you have to transmit it in. It's more expensive, right? So this is a way where over time we're able to actually start weaning off buying energy off the market, remote energy, and over time increase, you know, our local renewable energy portfolio. And that is the way we need to go if we really want to fight climate change, bring climate justice to local communities, employ people, stimulate the local economy, and actually have affordable, stable rates for energy.
Right. And, of course, it's more resilient. If a couple towers are blown up, or they blow down, and or they get burned down in some huge fire or whatever it is,
yeah,
a whole city can be without electricity. Whereas local energy, there might even be a storm in that city. Well, first they have storage, and they have other cities around it because you're confederated. You're still on a grid, right? And furthermore, you can repair it yourself fairly easily. They're high-tech, but they're very easy to, you know, any good carpenter and an electrician can repair a solar energy system or a wind turbine, requires that some mechanic, very quickly after a storm, versus putting up, repairing a grid that's going over mountains and that has gotten either blown up or blown down. That's a huge undertaking. It seems to me that if you really want a reliable source of energy, you keep it local with storage.
Yep. And that's one of the other incentives that we're trying to advocate for, is actually offering incentives if people add storage to their solar system.
Mm-hmm.
Other incentives would be if they're providing, you know, energy in a low-income community, then they would get more of an incentive. We call these community benefit adders. So then another adder would be if you use prevailing wage, family sustaining wage, or union labor, then that's another added benefit for the person that is producing solar. So we're really pushing for this local development, and we're also pushing, one thing that's really unique about our program is we advocated to have a local development business plan study done, which has now recently been completed. So we're at a place where now we're advocating to implement this local development business plan. And what that is just a plan for how we're going to wean off of the market and start producing our own local clean energy. And that's something that we're really trying to galvanize, bring together different, you know, sectors of communities, like, you know, not just clean energy folks, not just environmental justice folks, but the housing sector, social justice, and other leaders in the community to really advocate for this, because if we win all these things, this will benefit all of us in the East Bay.
And I suppose transportation and the people who are concerned with fish in the bay and the people who are concerned with birds and saving forests and stopping wildfires, all of them are going to benefit from a community, and even agricultural interests, right? They don't want huge grids crossing their land and the enormous machines that are required. It seems to me that this could be really a local organizing project that would change the culture of the counties who do community choice aggregation, who have their own local energy.
Yep, definitely. There's a lot at stake. I think we've unfortunately gotten to see all the negative effects of our dependence on dirty energy. I think this is a good time for us to step up for clean energy and for that resilience that, you know, we need to build, because, you know, when it comes to climate catastrophe, we're in the thick of it, and it's devastating to our communities.
Yeah, and another little thing, like having clean air or having air without mercury pollution.
Exactly.
Minor little things like that. Yes, this is KABU Radio, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Jessica Tovar, who has devoted a good part of her life to clean energy and to environmental justice. And now it must be for you, Jessica, really fulfilling to be part of now and a major organizer, among with as many, many organizers and a very large number of local energy activists in California. There are energy activists in every county, right, who are moving towards this model of clean energy, is my sense.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I've been working in environmental justice for well over 10 years. I even lost count. But just seeing the impact on people's health and really seeing the problem getting bigger, you know, what we really need to do is really push for clean energy, because that's really what's going to put dirty energy out of business. And so I'm in the right place to be doing this work that's more solutions-based. So really emphasizing that not only are we fighting dirty energy, but we're also putting forth the solutions to that problem.
Tell us about the unions. There was a time when the PGE union and the other, the California Edison union, the electrical workers were completely opposed to local energy. They were afraid, as are the big utilities, that they would be out of jobs, and the utilities who are losing their customers all over California and are being forced to just become a distributing agency. Okay. I mean, they do the billing, but that, and they do the repairing, but that's about all. And some of the repairing is going to be taken over by the locals. It seems to me the unions were opposed and, in fact, fought the local clean energy programs. That's changed, is my understanding. Nowadays, they're not campaigning for the opt-out. Explain all that.
Yeah, so one of the things to make clear is, yes, we do still get our bills from PG&E, because you have to understand, this is just the electrical portion of our bill. We're still paying the transmission costs. We're still using PG&E's infrastructure, right, because we don't yet own our own infrastructure for transmitting the electricity. But one of the things that's important to note is, in our organizing, we actually have come to the table with these same electrical unions to pretty much hash out whatever we needed to do and come to an understanding that it is in the best interest of our communities and for these unions to advocate for a local clean energy infrastructure, because that's where the local jobs piece would come. So in 2016, the labor unions, actually Alameda Labor Council, joined us in advocating to our decision makers to not only start a community choice program, but to make a strong commitment to this local build-out infrastructure for the jobs that it would create. So that actually was an unprecedented victory and a very hard organizing time, because, you know, there has been in past a lot of differences between, you know, the unions and the environmental movement, but we were able to come together. So fortunately, they're in support of, you know, local clean energy jobs being created in Alameda County. What they don't want to see is a community choice program that only buys energy off the market and then does nothing for the local sector. So that's something that we've been able to advocate for together. Unfortunately,
well, of course, on the market, you're buying jobs in your jobs are in North Dakota and New Mexico. North Dakota for wind and New Mexico and Arizona for solar. That's where the jobs are. After that, there are very few. So the unions, they did see now this is in the interest of their workers and their communities and their families.
Right. But we do see a lot of what happens is a lot of these dirty energy companies actually trying to sneak in language last minute into these legislative bills. And oftentimes that language is like what we call community choice energy killers. So we're constantly having to fight at the statewide level to maintain our local control and make sure that community choice is not being put out by these different legislative bills that, that we see several times at the 11th hour of the legislative time.
Yeah, they've got huge numbers of lobbyists and lawyers and a lot of politicians in their pockets. So they stick these things in right at the end, right, when no one, and they're, it's all quite secretive. And but you've managed to defeat them, is that is my sense, over time.
Yeah, we, it's either we defeat them or they get put on hold and then, you know, they come back the next year. So right now we are fighting something, and actually what it is, it's called AB 813. And what that threatens to do is it actually, we would lose our local state California power, decision-making power, and it would open up the possibility for cheap renewables out in other states to now put our local emphasis and jobs out of business. So we kind of describe it as the NAFTA, the NAFTA of clean energy. And so that's something that we're fighting, but also those same electrical unions are fighting alongside with us because their jobs, their local state jobs, are being threatened right now. So, you know, that would be a huge setback to California when we're trying really hard to produce our own local clean energy. And then, you know, we're going to be competing with this cheap stuff in other states.
Well,
that makes no sense because then we would also have to pay for the transmission.
Right.
So, it's the, you know,
it's only cheap if you don't consider the transmission costs.
Right. Exactly.
Which is, I mean, that's part of the game they play. They decided that when they build enough solar panels in paper over Arizona and New Mexico, somehow they can get the governments and the people through taxes to pay for their enormous grids and environment-destroying grids. But that doesn't stop them because they want to make money. Jessica, it's been really great talking to you. Why don't you bring your message up to Oregon and convince the, I'll call a special legislative session.
Okay.
Now they may not, accept that, but I think if the Oregon National Guard and the U.S. Army enforces it, that's going to be a problem too. But we're going to have a legislative session devoted to clean energy, and we're going to move towards a what's called community choice aggregation in California and other states that have it successfully. And so you'll be one of the speakers. Okay, so just stay ready to come to Oregon to point that out.
Yeah, that would be great. Can I leave you with some websites for the listeners to check out?
Sure.
Well, definitely check out localcleanenergy.org. That's who I work for. But then we also have a national effort with the Energy Democracy Project.
So oh, you're aligned with the Energy Democracy Project. That's great.
Oh, yeah. We helped found that group too. It's energydemocracy.us is that website. So you can check out what we're doing, not here, not only what we're doing here locally, but what other communities are doing throughout the United States to bring energy democracy to their communities.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, maybe you can say it again, what energy democracy does, it becomes a center point, the core of a environmental justice and environmental protection program in those local cities and counties and states, including transit and agriculture and all the rest. Is that summing up? Why don't you give a last pitch on a last discussion of that?
Sure. So the concept of democracy is very critical, especially at this point in time, right, in the United States. But energy democracy, what that's about is that if communities and people, regular ratepayers, come to the table and make decisions about our energy, that our system would look very different than what it does now. So what we're really doing is engaging the community to propose their own solutions in the community about the type of energy they would like to see used in their community. So that's exercising your energy democracy, actually making decisions that are best for our community as opposed to profits like these corporations have done in our communities.
Jessica Tovar, great to talk to you. Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
All right. Clean power to the people.
Excellent.
All right.
Can you call on your imagination as if telling a myth to a child? Put in the fantastical, wonderful, magical, add the romantic, the brave and the wild. Once upon a time there was a power so great that no one could know its name. People tried to claim it and rule with it, always such arrogance ended in shame. Thousands of years would pass in a moment, hundreds of cultures would come and go, each generation with a glorious calling, even when they were too busy to know. And then one day, after two millennia, which after all was a small part of time, hundreds of souls found their way out of nowhere to be on Earth at the threat of decline.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and the Monday Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Lori Mercier, and we just heard Bill Resnick and Jessica Tovar, an organizer for the Local Clean Energy Alliance of California, talk about how we, the people, can take over our energy systems and help create a green world. Now, here are Jan Hocken and Fran Michelle reviewing the film Sorry to Bother You.
Written and directed by hip-hop artist and activist Boots Riley, Sorry to Bother You is a satirical, allegorical tale of a young black man living in Oakland whose life is going nowhere. Cassius Cash Green, played by Lakeith Stanfield, is staying in the garage of his uncle and surviving day to day, hanging out with his artist-activist girlfriend, Detroit, played by Tessa Thompson. Cash puts together a phony resume and secures a job at Regal View, a telemarketing company. When he's advised by a colleague, played by Danny Glover, to use his, quote, white voice, Cash starts to move up the corporate ladder, eventually gaining access to the golden elevator taken only by the power callers. While Cash is seduced by the world of power callers, his Asian-American co-worker Squeeze, played by Steven Yeun, and his best friend Salvador, played by Jermaine Fowler, are organizing a work stoppage and union campaign at the call center. The moral conflict in this allegorical tale unfolds as Cash's attempts to rationalize his success confronts the brutal realities of a dehumanizing capitalist order. He must decide whose side he is on, as his former co-workers and friends fight the bosses in a wildly absurdist denouement of class struggle. Well, Fran, part of the film that's talked most about is this idea of performing whiteness, where the film really is clearly a political satire, and his co-worker, played by Danny Glover, gives him a tip, hey, young blood, use your white voice. To have a white voice is to sound breezy, carefree, like you don't really need the money. It's what white people wish they sounded like, Danny Glover says. So what about this theme of performing whiteness that's been taken up quite a bit by the film's devoted fans and critics?
Yeah, and the devotion is well-deserved. I mean, we want to say, you know, if you haven't seen this movie, run, don't walk. But yeah, the whiteness is not essentialized. It's a performance of ease and leisure and not needing of being worry-free.
It's denaturalized, so there's no, in the sense that whiteness also is a construct.
Yeah, whiteness is a performance just as blackness is a performance. Although the characters' voices are in fact dubbed by white actors, and a little bit out of sync to make it all the more surreal and weird. And it's a real thing, right? Code switching, or the idea that sounding white will present advantages is something that's been documented in social science, that there have been studies. In fact, if you sound white, you will succeed more.
And is he saying there that there are class inflections, there's a class hierarchy of racial codes throughout this film?
Yeah, of course.
Well.
Yeah, of course, there are white people working in the call center, so their white voice doesn't naturally sound worry-free or carefree, but it's very clearly coded in terms of whiteness as property, whiteness as wealth and comfort, upper-class whiteness.
And a fantasy of whiteness. And in a sense, just as gay men often can perform femininity in drag and a kind of perversely idealized picture of femininity, the black character knows how to perform whiteness in a way that white co-workers don't understand the codes, because he knows how to switch codes.
At one point later in the film, he's asked to perform blackness, which he has a little more trouble with, but manages to do to the satisfaction of most of the white people present. He's at a party asked to rap, because of course all black people know how to rap.
But I think it also registers something about the ambivalence that part of the white gaze, fascination with blackness, both avoiding it and fearing it, but also this fantasy of blackness as transgressive, as aggressive, and the consumption of rap, I think, conveys some of that ambivalence that's part of the white gaze. What about gender in this film? It's been praised for the intersectionality, as we say, of how racial representations come together and around class as a unifying social position, people coming together to fight the bosses. And there hasn't been as much written about the performance of gender in this, even though there's a performance artist at the center of the film, Detroit.
Yeah, well, she's not exactly at the center of the film. She's a little bit off-center. She's not the main character. She's the main character's girlfriend, as your introduction aptly described her. And that's her role in the film. And this film does not pass the Bechdel test, or the Bechdel-Wallace test, as it's sometimes called. Alison Bechdel, the cartoonist, and her friend Liz Wallace. This is from a 1980s era Dykes to Watch Out For strip, in which a character says she has a rule about what movies she'll go to see. It has to have two women who talk to each other about something other than a man. And the film does not pass that test. That is not a reason not to see it, but...
But on the other hand, she also works with the white gaze. She wears these earrings that have these big text, murder on one, kill on the other, and it's as though she knows what blackness evokes and arouses in the nervous, as they say these days, fragile white sensibilities and this fear of black people, and so she's kind of speaking back to that. She also performs.
She does this performance where she's wearing very little except some strategically located gloves and a pair of sunglasses, and then later in the performance she's wearing a helmet. She talks about the minerals that go into cell phones, which are extracted from Africa, and she has people at the gallery pelt her with bullet casings, cell phones, and balloons full of sheep's blood.
Which could be read as a masochistic performance, but I read it as her working with this idea of, even with this intensive exploitation, that Africa stands and can withstand, and it has not been destroyed by all of this exploitation, as the embodiment of a certain African resilience.
Which is a great reading, and I think works, because the character is somebody who definitely pushes back against her boyfriend's ideas. She likes him better when he's one of the workers before he becomes a power caller, and she ends up breaking up with him. At least one reviewer has used this as an argument that she does not fall into the trope of the manic pixie dream girl. The manic pixie dream girl being this kind of trope of the wild and crazy and free, creative young woman whose sole function in the film is to free up and help along the main character, who's a little more uptight and suffering and so on. And she's not quite that, but I don't think that the film really subverts that trope. She's not there to have her own story, although she does have more of a trajectory than your average manic pixie dream girl.
So what about this worry-free world of workers? I mean, the worry-free world is a worry for the capitalists, though. That also is a theme in the film. There's always a threat of resistance. We don't see it among the producers, but this idea that under capitalism there's always a threat of resistance is, I think, an idea that the director is committed to politically, creating and participating in resistance and films like this that show the possibility of resistance.
When Riley was on Democracy Now, he talked about the way that the left has sort of moved to emphasizing spectacle and demonstrations and away from, as he says, actually organizing at the point of contradiction in capitalism, which is the exploitation of labor, which is also where the working class has its power. And so really he's emphasizing, the film is emphasizing the importance of withholding labor in the process of gaining power as workers. That is what the union struggle in this call center develops into. And of course, at that point, Cash is, just as they start this drive, they have a brief work stoppage, and then he's promoted to power caller. And so he tries to sort of say, well, I'm on your side, I'm cheering for you from the sidelines, but then he ends up having to cross the picket line in order to get to his job. And we've got scenes of these incredibly armored up goons, G4 Wackenhut types of soldiers, really, protecting the scabs and the workers who are going into the call center building through the picket line.
And someone throws a can at him. And then this, I think, another interesting way in which the film departs from some of the liberal ways of thinking about resistance is that he becomes quite preoccupied with exposing the brutality of the world he's now part of. But just exposing it becomes the video of him having a can thrown at him. It circulates and becomes a meme and part of kind of pop culture. So it, in a very clever way, works with this idea that it's not enough to just expose the inhumanity of capitalism.
But it can be part of it, or it can be, those kinds of images can be used in subversive and progressive ways for organizing. So, and he finds out some stuff about this company that sends him over the edge. It's no longer worth being a power caller. It's too horrifying, and he wants to expose it, which he does after, I mean, he goes through a lot. He suffers further violence in order to bring this to public attention. And then, as it turns out, instead of everybody saying, oh my God, this is terrible, we must shut down this company immediately, their stock goes up. And the CEO appears on television with Democrats and Republicans praising his prowess and the new creative frontiers in employment and labor that they're moving toward. So that just the thing that he thinks is going
to break through
doesn't.
Yeah. Right? And capitalism can always incorporate the critique.
And the organizer, Squeeze, points out that when people find out something horrible, if they don't have a way to address it, they're just going to find a way to ignore it, because there's no other way to move forward if you don't know what to do about it, right? How do you stop something like this? But the can on the head, which becomes a meme and he's laughed at for it, actually also becomes part of their resistance strategy when they're fighting back against the union-busting thugs. Everybody dresses up in these costumes with a wig and a Coke can on their head so that they can't tell who's who. And so it becomes a kind of camouflage to use that as a way of confusing the dominant powers as part of a larger strategy for organizing and rebellion.
So that images and representations can be taken up in multiple ways, and the film can be perhaps used in social movements in different ways. There's perhaps a risk of always of satire and irony that's playful to be remain at that level of part of a satirical critique of capitalism that falls short of confronting it. But I think the aim of the filmmaker is to contribute to social movements and to think about class and resistance, if even in this science fiction Afrofuturistic fantasy way, that there are always possibilities for resistance that we haven't figured out yet what forms they'll take.
Yeah, and one of the things that Riley said in the Q&A he did when he was in Portland is that somebody sort of asked him about this tension between, he's saying representation isn't enough, but he's making a movie. Isn't that another representation? How does that fit in? And one of the things he said was that it's important to have different kinds of stories, and that different kinds of stories can be enabling for people to take different kinds of action. The story alone is not going to be enough, but it's a contribution toward that. And I think that this movie does that. I mean, it gives us, in this very surreal way that I think is quite in tune with the surrealism of actually existing life under capitalism today. It gives us ways to think about the importance of organizing and the possibility of organizing and of people coming together across different categories. I mean, when they have this rebellion, which culminates in a successful unionizing drive, doesn't completely overthrow capitalism, but they organize their workplace. And that's something, right? That having that story is important. And there aren't enough movies that offer us stories of labor organizing. They're few and far between. And it's great to have one that's this much fun.
Yeah. This is Jan Hawken and Fran Michelle talking today about Sorry to Bother You.
Thanks to Jan Hawken and Fran Michelle for that review of Boots Riley's film, Sorry to Bother You, which brilliantly offers an accessible critique of life under capitalism. Fran and Jan will have additional audio, including a spoiler discussion of the ending for those who have already seen the film, posted online later in the week. Sorry to Bother You is playing at local theaters, and you can put a hold on copies that will be coming into the Multnomah County Library. With us now is Martin Duberman, Distinguished Professor of History Emeritus at City University of New York, where he founded and directed the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies. He is the author of dozens of award-winning histories, biographies, memoirs, essays, plays, and novels, including books on Paul Robeson, Stonewall, Howard Zinn, and Haymarket. And he's the author of an important new book, Has the Gay Movement Failed?, that we want to discuss today. Thanks so much for joining us on KABU, Martin Duberman.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You have been a radical activist in writing about the political left and gay rights movement for decades. What prompted you to write, Has the Gay Movement Failed?
My discontent with the direction of the movement has been mounting really for quite some time. I was active in the early 70s in the post-Stonewall period when the contemporary gay movement as we know it began to develop. And I was far more sympathetic then to the agenda of the movement than I am currently, because I feel that the radical critique that represented the early movement, the lack of single-issue politics, and instead a broad assault on racism, sexism, and classism, I think that's been gradually fading over the years. And in the last 15 or 20 years, as exemplified by the Human Rights Campaign, which is now the largest LGBTQ organization with an annual budget of many millions, that organization and the current agenda of the gay movement was for 20 years, roughly, confined primarily to the two issues of serving openly in the military, excuse me, and winning the right formally to marry, neither of which objectives have I ever been in great sympathy with. And I think it's, well, alas, I feel that those issues do, however, represent what the majority of LGBT people have wanted over the last 20 years. I mean, that leads into huge, you know, questions and statements. For example, is it impossible for a radical movement to maintain its momentum? Is it always the case throughout our history that the kind of passionate intensity of the early days of a movement inevitably, quote unquote, give way to a kind of assimilationist agenda?
And of course, you've been studying social justice and radical movements for your entire career, so I can understand why you might lean towards concluding that. But what was it about the Gay Liberation Front that offered so much more transformative possibilities than the more recent LGBTQ movements have done?
I think the whole climate of the day, the national climate, which would include, you know, the second half of the 60s and the first few years of the 70s, it was a national mood that encouraged experimentation, encouraged directly facing the assorted atrocities that characterize our economic and social structure. What in part accounts for the change after the early 70s is, I think, a whole host of economic shifts which saw our economy faltering, threw many people out of work, led to the decline of industrialization and unionization. The whole bloom was off the rose, as it were. This wasn't any longer a society of endless expectations in which we could push forward the frontiers in all directions. It became instead a society focused on, you know, securing a daily livelihood. And that deepened and worsened throughout the 70s and led in 1980, of course, to the election of Ronald Reagan.
Well, you also write that the post-1980s LGBTQ movement has moved away from the kind of inclusiveness and really intersectionality that the Gay Liberation Front offered in the early 70s in challenging gender roles and concepts of love and sexuality and issues of imperialism and race and social justice, and that this post-1980s movement has really been focusing on inclusiveness in the body politic through marriage or rights to join the military, has really lost sight of that more radical restructuring of society, has it not?
Yes, this whole notion of being included in the body politic, I think, involves deep unconscious deception on the part of LGBT people. We are not just folks. We have had a different historical experience. We have been outsiders for a very long time, and as a result, we've formed different perspectives. Those differences are now being denied across the board in order to persuade mainstream America that we are just folks and therefore are entitled to all of our civil rights. And what I also think is involved there is what I just said earlier, namely that this is a process that, in my reading anyway, the majority of gay people themselves do embrace. Life is hard. We want to be accepted by our neighbors. We want to be seen as just folks with the same aspirations and goals and emotions and so forth. It's a very, very understandable phenomenon, given how limited and difficult our lives are, that we don't want to constantly be fighting battles based especially on how different we are and our, how different our perspectives are. So if my reading is accurate, I understand the wish and the need to feel accepted. It seems to me a very human need, but alas, at the same time, it runs counter to any campaign for significant social renovation.
Well, your book is also important, I think, for its critique of the left as well, for failing time and time again to embrace the queer potential for social transformation. As you just noted, LGBTQ movements should not claim that they're just like everyone else in order to emphasize the transformative possibilities of LGBTQ activism and the redistribution of power, et cetera.
Yes, I think this whole notion that we really are just mainstreamers, in a sense, has played into the hands of what we need to call, I guess, the straight left, which is silly, but I don't know how else to characterize it. The non-gay left might sound slightly better. Because they want to believe that we have nothing to tell them about their lives, not simply about who we are, but who they might be if only they opened their ears and paid attention to what we have experienced and what we are now willing to share about our understanding of gender, for example, our understanding of sexual monogamy and so forth, of family, of friendship. I mean, there's a whole litany here of possibilities. But I've read widely in the non-gay left literature that is emerging, and I read Jacobin, which is currently, you know, the chic new journal that represents the non-gay left. And you not only don't you hear much, if anything, about gay people and what they might have to tell us, but you also don't hear much about feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Which in part may be a comment on the current state of the feminist movement as well. But I think the non-gay left, as it's currently manifesting itself in the new generation, is primarily, like the old left of the 1930s, is primarily concerned with economic issues, with classism, and also, to be fair, with racism. It's less concerned with sexism and with sexual orientation.
And challenging the gender binary.
Yeah, oh, yes. I mean, someone, in fact, who interviewed me recently, who will be nameless, but who told me that she did write an article on transgenderism for Jacobin, but had a somewhat difficult time with the people there, because apparently isn't clear to them how much transgenderism has to tell all of us about the mutability of gender, you know, and the nonsense of the old binary, which insists that men and women innately, genetically, have different characteristics and therefore are destined for different social roles.
Mm-hmm.
I think that view remains widely held in the populace at large, and I don't see the non-gay left doing much to dispel it.
And Martin Duberman, we just have a few minutes, but just as the straight left or non-gay left has ignored issues of gender and sexuality and LGBTQ issues, How has the LGBTQ movements ignored Black, brown, and working class LGBTQ people? It seems to me that's another important part of your book, that as there has become wider acceptance of LGBTQ people, the actual lives of Black, brown, and working class LGBTQ people have declined in recent decades.
I think that's absolutely right. And somewhat disgraceful in terms, certainly, of our large national organizations. They're becoming somewhat more conscious, but primarily today they've been operating in the name of the agenda put forward by primarily white male middle and upper class men. Oh, I said men. And, you know, the vast majority of gay people are, in fact, do not fit those categories. They are working class people. The gay movement, even in its earliest days, when it was at its most radical, there was a great deal of struggle within GLF and GAA, the two then current organizations, over issues relating to race and class, and also in regard to gender. Finally, a lot of the women in GLF gave up on their male brothers because they found the sexism so deeply ingrained, even in gay men who claim to be across-the-board radicals.
Martin Duberman, we thank you so much for joining us today on KBOO, and we want to encourage people to read your book, Has the Gay Movement Failed?
Thanks very much.
That's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Want to thank our contributors today, especially Patsy Colbert for engineering. And that's it.